Sirenauts, and welcome to this week's episode of Observations with me, your host, Sovereign Sire. This is my podcast. I am brought to you by the Bon Vivants and Ne'er-Do-Wells at Julieland.com, and as always, I am joined by the wonderful Mr. Richard Avery.
Hi.
Yeah. It's been like over a year and a half, and I still have nothing witty to say back. There's banter.
We need to come. You know what I'm going to need? I need to come. I need to come up with like the daily joke or something like that. Stupid childish thing.
My guest today, who is making crowd noises, is a singer and songwriter, Jalan. Say hello.
Hello. Hi, Sovereign. Hi, everyone. Hi, Richard Avery.
Hello.
Shh. I don't know how to make crowd sounds, but sorry, next time. Yeah.
Exactly.
So Melanie Vesey wrote to me, and she said this lady has just done a really great album that she did a Kickstarter for, and it's with the pianist from David Bowie, and it's a really special, beautiful project. And I checked it out, and I was like, yeah, come on the show.
Yes.
So how did you get to I'm going to make a Kickstarter, and I'm going to do...
Yeah.
Like, because the album, like, you raised a significant amount of money.
I did.
It was not, like...
I did. That was a small miracle in itself, and kind of started this whole journey, which has been, like, a four-year process, which is sort of an important piece of...
A little closer.
Of this project. And I did a Kickstarter because I had been working on some originals projects, and I was working with a guy named Michael Farrell is someone I've worked with for years for my first album, and we had been working on these songs, and I had this one song, and there was this middle section, and I was like, I just want that pianist Mike Garson, you know, like, because I have loved his music forever. The Aladdin Sane album, Lady Grinning Soul, that song, like, just changed my... To segue, when I was 19, I fell in love with French music. So when I heard Lady Grinning Soul and I heard that piano, it was just like a mashup. And I just had this thought in my head, and Mike Farrell said, you know, he lives here, you should contact him. And I literally, there was no Facebook, I MySpaced him in 2010. I MySpaced him. Can you imagine?
Wow.
And in 2010?
In 2010, I MySpaced him. I was like, I'm a fan and I'd love to work with you one day. And then I didn't have any money to do it, but he was like, send me some of your stuff. And I did. And he was like, yeah, cool. I'd be into that. And then a couple of years later, it just wasn't letting up. And Kickstarter was born and Facebook was born. And like, really, me and technology. So I did that Kickstarter to raise money to finish that album and to do some recording with Mike Garson and a French song by Jacques Brel that I love called La Chanson des Vieux Amants, which is, and Ne Me Quitte Pas, which are like two of my favorite, biggest influences. And I recorded, so we started with kind of jazzy songs and French songs, and it just, oh my God, it's such a long story, but like it morphed. But that Kickstarter was the beginning of working with Mike and developing this relationship.
So when did you do the Kickstarter and how much did you raise?
The Kickstarter I did in May of 2012, and I raised $17,000. And what is really amazing about that is that there was 136 people, lots of little things, and it was so down to the wire. I was like $4,000 or $5,000 off my point like 2 days before it closed. And then there was this surge, like, which happens with a lot of Kickstarters. Right. But then there was this amazing donor named Wanda who came in at the end with a $3,000 contribution, like a huge contribution, and just put me over the top. And she's why I funded, really. I mean, you know, everybody. It was a collective
experience. How did you get interest in your Kickstarter? Like, what was it about the album that was like getting people to...
I think for me, it was like I had this music from before with Mike Farrell. So he and I had some originals. I already had a foundation, and in my video, it was also this French influence, and I had French music, and it was Mike Garson, and it was this Mike Garson, this pianist. He's an icon. I mean, he really is an American icon pianist, and I think now, because of what's going on and the still tragic death of Bowie, and he's having a resurgence, but he really... You know, like, unless you really maybe knew Bowie, and still some people are discovering him now, but maybe that was kind of the combination of that, I think, was what really, I don't know how I did. I don't know. I still don't know. Like, I still am shocked that happened.
So where did you record it?
So we recorded, and this is all songs that are not on Not Alone. This is not this album. It's kind of crazy. We have a flurry of material and things coming out because it's been a 4-year process.
So is
and
he
relationship.
Like now your collaborator?
He became out of that. We started with a few songs and a couple days in the studio. And I remember before I did the Kickstarter, I had only Facebooked with Mike. And he was like, yeah, I remember you. And let me see. He told me later that he gets hit up all the time. And I was only the third person he ever agreed to do anything with.
That's awesome.
Which was a huge honor.
Yeah.
And he and I just gelled musically in this really amazing way. And it started this relationship. And he became he's now a very dear friend of mine, but and a mentor. And he really understood at that time in my life and artistically, he's like, I think this is as much a spiritual journey as it is musical for you. And he's 72-year-old sage. He comes from another space with music. And when you listen to Bowie and you know the story about how those songs were recorded on Aladdin Sane and how they were one take, and, then he Lady Grinning Soul that we later recorded in 2014, he hadn't even played that start to finish until the day we recorded it in August of 2014. Yeah. I mean, goosebump moment. I mean, so he and I just sort of became in this snowball, and it really has been a big journey for me. I moved to Paris in the process because we're going to be doing some French stuff. That was the same. We did these recordings, and when it all does kind of come back to Not Alone, the glam covers album, because when we were recording the French stuff, he was like, something happens to your voice when you sing in French. And I was like, yeah, it's because I love French, and when I speak French, I feel more in my skin, and I just, that's my thing. And when we first spoke, we talked about Bowie stuff, of course, how could I not ask a little? But he was like, it wasn't the right time, he was really like, I don't want to be a caricature of myself, and I don't want you to get slammed for doing that, who's this girl? And it was just, and also, we were just meeting, and we both had a lot of jazz influences, and he loved the French. And so after, he said to me, I love when you sing in French, maybe we should do a duets album. And I said, oh yeah, maybe we should. And then I kind of replied, maybe if I translate Lady Grinning Soul into French, then maybe that'd be a way we could record it. And he was like, yeah. And I said, okay, plane ticket booked. I had lived in Paris in 2004, and I had been trying to kind of get back there. And so I just said, all right. And I got 4 months later, I got on a plane. And
I know this sounds crazy, because now you're going to leave here and I'm going to go listen to the music. But when I think of French singer music, I think of Claudine Lauger.
Yeah.
Is that kind of vibe?
Is
she just that whispery kind of?
Yeah, that's what I think of. Serge Gainsbourg era, whispers,
the 60s, sultry. That soft. That's what I think of.
I have a couple songs like that. Lady Grinning Soul is like that. Okay. And a song that Mike really loves, By This River, is like that on Not Alone. But there's a flip side to me that's an era before that in French music. Since I've been living in Paris, I've had this discussion a lot about that. And a French friend of mine explained to me the other day, Serge Gainsbourg sort of shifted the French game with that sort of whispery, Frenchy 60s thing. But before that, there was Nicolette and other powerful, Juliet Greco, lay it on you. Cool. Rock and Roll Suicide we did. And by the end of Rock and Roll Suicide, which John Taylor co-produced with me, starts with me almost talking.
Right.
Talking, but by the end, it's a full on in your face, letting it all hang out.
So how did you get to the point where you were a singer? Where do you come from? What was your,
my creative?
Yeah. When did you become a musician? When did that
I was singing from walking.
Where are you from? Where were you born?
I'm born in San Francisco, raised in Los Angeles, in Pasadena. Okay. And I was just singing out of the gate. And I think I was probably 6 or 7. No one was listening to opera, but I would run around the house. I'm an opera. I sing opera. Young person, just pretending to be a little singer. And then I started doing theater and singing in musicals and things. But I was always singing, and all through high school. And I was just...
Did you go to a performance arts high school?
I didn't go to a performance arts high school, and I played the piano when I was young and the guitar, and then I quit the piano when I was young because other things became more enticing to me.
Were your family musicians or were you kind of a unique
My grandfather was a jazz guitar player.
Okay.
And he was a really cool cat. And he died in Paris. Okay. On vacation with my parents when I was 9.
Okay.
And so my whole family sang, and my sisters, I have 2 older sisters and a younger brother. My 2 older sisters sang, and my brother is a musician. He's much younger than I am, but does amazing hip hop stuff. And he's dope. I love him. And so all of us, music was kind of in the family, but nobody was like doing music or musician. But we were creative people.
So was that a scary decision to be like, I'm going to be a singer? Like, how many day jobs did you have before
Yes, I did. Yes, yeah. I was always singing, always performing. Crazy stories, like in high school, you know, like I sang soul and blues and like R&B. Like I was raised on like hip hop and like that was my scene. I loved rock and all kinds of music, but and I was always writing and I was always singing, and singing was always in my mind. But then like life was happening, and there's something about me. I was sort of like a late bloomer in it, I think, into myself. Mm-hmm. But always trying and always doing it. And then I started doing makeup and hair in the music business. So then mm-hmm. I was like in the milieu.
Right.
You know how they talk about that? And I think it's like that Artist Way book woman talks about how artists, if they don't do the thing that they are here to do, they wind up like subconsciously putting themselves in the milieu of that mm-hmm. thing.
Right. Yeah.
You know what
Very
I mean? Like
so.
A writer will become an editor, right? You know
yeah,
what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that was kind of my thing. And in that
consciously or subconsciously, you think?
Subconsciously, because I didn't plot it. I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to do makeup and hair and work in the music business. Yeah. That was not my thing. I didn't know that. That was not on my trajectory at all. It just sort of happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I did in my 20s, I did like demos and recordings with, I was out a lot with when Soul Asylum was doing Golden Smog with Jeff Tweedy and the Jayhawks and that whole Minneapolis scene. I did recordings with them out in Minneapolis. And I was floating around and everybody knew that I did music and I was singing, but I wasn't really owning that.
Right.
And I was doing makeup for all of these artists who loved me and I loved them. And they loved me because guess what I had? Mm. I had that creative energy. I had that, and I was giving it. You know, I was like, here you go. Have all my...
How long were you doing that before you kind of finally owned your shit?
I did that for... I did. I did that for about 15...
You finally like owned your shit.
I did that for about 15 years, and no joke, I did own my shit. And what I did was I moved to Paris. And I said, okay, because I was like, I got to get out of here. Golden handcuffs. Like, I'll never get out of this job or do music if I stay in LA. So I'm like, I'm going to Paris. It's my dream. I'm a gypsy. I lived in Northern Ireland twice. I'm like, Paris. So I go to Paris. And then an artist that I worked with said, come do this tour with me for 4 months. I said, okay. I put my stuff in storage in Paris. And it turned into a year and a half. And by the end of that, I was like, okay, that's it. I'm done. I'm retired. And like I came back to LA, my stuff like literally drowned in my friend's cave underground thing. And it took me 10 years to get back there. But I came back off that tour and everyone that I knew was like, hey, how's it going? And what are you doing? Who are you working with? I was like, oh, no, I don't do that anymore. I retired. Mm. I used that word. I retired. And they're like, what? Mm. I was like, yeah, what do you mean? I'm like, oh, I'm making a record. I'm doing music.
Yeah.
And within 6 months, easily, maybe less, everyone I knew, even people that knew me, that knew I was a singer and that loved my music and what I did, but would always be like, oh, it's my friend Jolene. She does makeup and hair. Like, you know, it was like, oh, it's my friend Jolene. She's a singer. Oh, and I referred to myself as a singer and people around me referred to myself as that. And everything, it's like.
It shifts. It totally does. I know exactly what you're saying.
It totally shifts. Yep. And that, I've not looked back. That was 2005, and I've not looked back.
You decided to go into the studio. The first album that you did, were you doing covers or were you writing? Had you been writing the whole time?
I had been writing since I was a teenager.
Okay, so you had been writing. You had a cachet of stuff.
Oh my God. My friend Holly Cook, who I adore, Paul Cook's daughter, who is an amazing artist. She does, I love her. Holly, I was with her in Paris the other day at a show, and I was like, I'll sell your merch. So I was selling her merch, and afterwards, she looked over at me, and she's like, you know, I have that tape. And she's like, you know, you're like who I looked up to when I was little. I had your tape, and I used to listen to it on repeat, my cassette demo tape. I was like, Holly, no one has this tape. Like, I literally, because I was working with the Pistols, and Paul and Chris Thomas and I became friends. And so somehow then I stayed in touch with the Cookies, and like, they're, I love them. And so, but that kind of thing where it was like, there, somebody all these years later saying, I had the cassette tape and your music was influencing me. And I'm like looking at her like, what? Because I love what she does. So I'm like, right. I'm loving you. Like,
yeah.
So yeah, I had been always writing and always.
Okay. So you make a demo.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
I make the demo and I pass it around to some people. I do some shows kind of sort of. I think probably if you asked me what was the glitch, like, what was the glitch wasn't what I had done. The glitch was myself. And the glitch was the transitioning into live. Like, when I sing, I like to just sing. I don't play an instrument when I'm singing. I play my instrument to kind of write and to create. And I think the turning point became in my first record. I worked, I had met a guy named Rami Jaffe along the way. He's a B3 player. He was at that time in the Wallflowers. Now he's the Foo Fighters, and he plays with a ton of people. And
he's a legend.
He's a legend. Yeah, he's a legend. And Rami, after I quit that tour and I was like, I'm retired, I had this cachet. Mm-hmm. And Rami said, oh, you need to meet my friend Evan and do the project here. And so my first album is Rami Jaffe, Evan Frankfurt, Michael Farrell, who had just come from Rome doing an album with Morrissey, and Evan Frankfurt is legend in his realm of what he does. And Evan was the one who, well, I'm like, who's producing it? You know, and Evan was like, you are, because you hear music in a very specific and very particular way that's really unique. And so you are a kind of songwriter in your head, and you the kind that needs to then, you have your chords and your setup, but you translate it, and you need, he was the one who opened my eyes to maybe owning the beginning of that. And Mike Garson was like the fucking, sorry, can I swear?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
He was the fucking follow up.
But it sounds like, it just sounded like you needed to kind of, like you were saying, like own it. You just needed to wake up one day and say, I'm a singer. Mm-hmm. Fuck it. Like,
yeah.
And it seems like no
backdoor job.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
no safety net.
I'm a singer, but I'm going to powder your face. Yeah. And you're really the singer because you're doing it. And all that shit about, like, listen, I love all music musicians, and I'm not sliding, but this tier, if you're making it, you're making it. Mm-hmm. And you're doing it. Right. If you're creating, you're creating.
Right.
And it's a hard realm, because there's this thing that exists that is our egos and the fear and all of that. And like, if you're not doing it at a certain level and a certain way, then less or better, all that shit, you know? And so when you're me and you're working in the music industry, that was my demons plagued me in that way. Yeah. And I needed to,
it's like a lot of musicians I meet these days, I always tell them, you do music cause you love it. Don't do it cause you're going to become rich and famous off of it.
Yeah.
Cause it's harder now than it's ever been.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
If you get to perform, I just worked with some friends a couple of weeks ago, and I said to them, if you get to get on a stage and perform, that's it. That's what it's all about. If you're doing it because you want to sell out the Coliseum and make millions of dollars, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And because, by the way, I have all of these friends over the years, some all varying degrees of success, and it pains me to see the anger and bitterness that they have in them.
Exactly.
Against music.
Yep.
And so I have to kind of say, like, I think I somehow dodged some sort of weird bullet without realizing it, because everything I do now, granted, it's hard and it's a challenge, but I can always come back to the center of, like, I created what I wanted.
Yeah.
And also my record, and I'm an indie artist, you know, I'm truly independent. I financed all my music, like Kickstarter and me.
Yeah.
I sold my house to create the last few years of what I've been doing.
Exactly.
Like, that's, I'm all in.
Yeah.
Like, there's no joke going on.
I mean, and what's that? How is that? I mean, that's really scary, you know?
Well,
I did. I mean, I think everyone's done it in different ways. Like, I have like different, everyone has like their moment where they go like, I'm doing something I kind of am not going to be able to get on the other side of, like, in, you know, trying to facilitate a dream. What got you to that point? Like, what was that like, that decision, making that decision and
just to go all in like
that?
After the retiring and the making of the first record, that there was kind of no looking back from there. So then I did a few makeup and hair jobs after, you know, that were just like reminded me that that was hell and I didn't want to do that anymore. Right. And love all the people I work with, but just for my own personal reasons. And I think the meeting of Mike Garson and a lot of things that fell into place. Right. And it's hard to explain. I don't know. I think there was just something that knew, like, I think partly for me, the living that many years of kind of a lie, there was a lot of pain in that for me. Mm-hmm. It was very challenging. And so getting to that kind of like almost a bottom of just like, if I don't say I tried, if I don't do this, I'm gonna regret it. And I was slow. I felt myself sort of slowly dying too on the inside, like slow death on the inside. Yeah. And so I guess to answer your question, like the final thing was I did this leap of faith and I went back to Paris, the Mike Garson and the French thing. And I knew I got to Paris and about, it took me days, but a weekend, I felt like somebody attached wings to my body. And I was just like, oh, I'm home. Like I'm very, like that's my city. And I said, okay, so I'm staying here. And then because I was there, I went over and John was making a record with Duran Duran, John Taylor. And he was like, oh, you should pop over. And I was like, yeah. And Jenny and Paul and Holly all live in London. I was like, oh, okay. And I went and I had done Perfect Day with Mike Garson. And he heard Perfect Day. He hadn't really heard a lot of what I was doing. He was just a friend. He had become a friend out of other things, not because of music. And I had never worked with him in as a makeup artist. So we were just like outside of all that. Right. And he was like, oh my God, wait a minute. And he loved Mike. And he's like, this is amazing. You're like this young artist, female singer person. And here's this icon who's never really gotten his proper due, really. And the Perfect Day, what'll come out later at some point, it's not on Not Alone, but it'll be a little bonus single later in the year. He's like, he was blown away. And he's like, and I told him about Lady Grinning Soul in French. And he was like, okay. And he started pondering it. And John, he's so creative. And once he goes, he's just like, whoosh, his mind moves so fast. And he's like, I really think you should do more. You should delve into the whole glam era. Like, why not do more and do more Bowie and go for it? And this was in April of 2014. And I was in Paris and there I was, and I knew I wanted to be there and here, and I needed to finish this other album I was making with Mike Farrell, which will come out later this year. And then there was just like, when life presents itself, you can't say like, oh no, hold on, you idea, because I'm doing this idea. So you just have to, and the Kickstarter, it was pressure. I was like, what am I doing?
Yeah. But I look at it always, it's, these are opportunities and you just have to go for them. And it's like, in my attitude these days is just that it's never, should I do this one? You know, A, B, C, or D? Yeah. And I always say the answer is E, all of the above.
Yes. And that is exactly what happened. And that like answers, that is totally what happened. And that answers your question, because I came to LA to do Lady Grinning Soul and Time and Quicksand, a few Bowie songs, some Mick Ronson with this iconic piano. Like, it's a historic moment. So I was there. I came to do like maybe 4 or 5 songs, and it turned into 16 and it turned into 2 albums later. Yeah. I mean, Kickstarter, like, this has been a whole thing. And it was the moment of like, and I think my amazing parents, my mom, my dad just looked at me and was like, you have a dream and you have a house. And if you sell it, you get to live your dream.
Yeah.
Go for it. Like, that's it. You know, and I did, I said like, okay, like,
living dreams are not cheap.
Live in musical dreams. You know, I love that. People always say like, oh, the music industry, oh, music, you can make it at home. And it's, everybody's got their home studio. I'm like, Not the kind I do.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Mike Garson does not play on a keyboard. Like, yeah, it's exactly. A grand piano. And yeah. Our event, I'm renting a 9-foot Steinway grand. Tomorrow, I'm going down to downtown Steinway to choose it with Mike. Mm. And we're going to sit there and he's going to choose his...
When are you performing?
On Saturday night.
Where at?
In Altadena at a private home called Villa Carlotta.
Ooh.
Just acoustic. Him on the 9-foot grand and me.
Wow.
Just a real, oh my God, it's going to be amazing.
It sounds like it.
It's going to be amazing. Yeah, you guys got to come. You come
out. No, I got the invitation, but I host a variety show that same night. Darn. So it's like.
Ah, darn.
I might be able to come for a brief moment.
Is there going to be a mosh pit? I'll be there. No.
An acoustic mosh. It's going to be an acoustic mime. It's going to be mime mosh, exactly. You know?
Exactly.
But I have to go early because I'm the producer and the co-host. So okay. I have to.
Well, hopefully there'll be more. I hope this is just the entree.
So, yeah. What else?
I was going to say, is it a private event, or is it just you're all?
It's open.
Okay.
To the public.
Okay.
I've put it out there, you know, in that way, and we'll see how many people. You know, I'm going to cap it if it gets to be too crazy because it's, you know, but. I think it'll fit enough. It's a beautiful home. It's like a big wood library. It's a gorgeous.
Wow, sounds impressive.
So how is like as?
Excuse me to interrupt, but please tell me you're filming it.
Yes.
Okay.
I hope.
Please.
I try. I've learned. I've had a gnarly learning curve about filming and making
this
sure.
Day you
this
you
is, I guess this film. Is what I was going to ask you about. Is like, so how has it been, kind of as an independent? Because I just had a rap artist in here, Open Mike Eagle, and we were talking about. As an independent artist, like the need to sort of like connect with fans and kind of be on social media, like kind of create a network as an independent artist to like go, you know what I mean? To kind of like build up a fan base that will support you essentially. Yeah. Because there's so many people that are working artists that aren't Beyonce that are, but still manage to make a living as musicians through kind of having like a fan base that will go out to the shows and buy all the records.
Yeah.
How has it been adapting to that kind of,
probably the most challenging part, I'd say. My Kickstarter people, some of them might be like, she sucked at it. And I'm so sorry, all you Kickstarter people. I love you. I'll be better. But I think, and maybe hearing a little of my trajectory, it makes sense that like that aspect of being out there, this is what I'm doing. Look where I am right now. And this is what's happening. And here we are in the studio. When I'm in the studio or when I'm in creating mode, I'm and maybe you can hear it in my music. Some people's feedback sort of say like it's very emotional and raw. John, actually, when he heard Perfect Day and some of the stuff Mike and I initially did, one of the biggest compliments I ever had. We were in London driving around the countryside, and he was like, I was talking to him about vulnerability and how I was really trying to just let my guard down and let myself be vulnerable on Earth. And he was like, yeah, you put it in your music. And I was like, what? Because I was not consciously doing it. He's like, yeah, you know, it's so raw. I was almost jealous. Like, how could you do that? And I kind of looked over to him and I was like, first off, thank you. And second off, wow, I hadn't thought about that. And that, when you couple that with then needing to be, who lives like what they have no skin and wants to like put themselves out in the world. It's a hard learning curve.
Yeah.
And I think now I'm just in the last year or so, like I'm just getting better and kind of learning it. And even with the putting out of Not Alone and working with Melanie Vessi at Promotional Rescue.
Yeah.
Like working with Melanie, like doing all that, like that whole kind of learning curve.
Because she's like she does workshops on that. Like that's sort of her,
she is schooling me, and I am. And also because this journey was so long, it was hard to explain like to my Kickstarter people, to even my family and friends. I couldn't explain to myself, you guys, I did not set out to have a 4-year journey of 2 records plus a half of a jazz album. Like hello, I have like 30 songs. Right. I didn't plan that. It's just that I was just.
But it sounds like a dream. But the thing about it all is, in this day and age, you could make the greatest music in the world. You can make the greatest cupcake in the world. If nobody knows about it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So you ding, have ding. It's part of the process. And as I just had this speech recently with somebody, which was yesterday, you're not in the music business. You're in the business of music.
Yeah.
And you, it's business first, and you got, yeah, you have to balance the art and commerce of it all, and you, yeah, have to get out and, and it, I know it is a learning curve to get, yeah, to deal with, but you, yeah, still have to do it. You, yeah, still have to do it. And my advice to everybody all the time is just like, you got to just have fun with it, yeah, take control of it, be, yeah, creative with it. The, yeah, the example I like to use is U2.
Yeah.
Their entire career, they've taken control of their image, the, yeah, look, everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. It's like, yeah, and it's their vision for everything.
You're right. And I think if I could say anything, because I would say that I wouldn't be the model. Like, so I have to talk about it from a what not to do perspective almost, like on myself, you know, like call myself out. And if anybody was listening to me and was going to be like, what would your suggestion be? I would probably say what I learned, because I have been doing this for that many years and I haven't been as proactive on social media as I should have been. Trying, you know, like, oh, here, a tweet there, but not enough live shows, not this. I perform a lot more in Paris than I do LA. But like, my suggestion would be perhaps to not take yourself so seriously in that realm. You can be in the studio and you can be serious about what you're doing, but when I linked up that seriousness and allowed it to infiltrate what the social media aspect of and the business of being music is, mm-hmm, that created a dissonance that made it hard for me, because I felt, so I had to kind of then, I think it's better to just kind of lighten up and be like, oh, nobody's caring. It doesn't have to be the perfect, you know, and I'm a very detail-oriented music.
Just, but you just have to have fun with it. And one of, yeah, those details needs to be having fun with it.
Yeah.
Because you're doing what you do. We all do. I know you, yeah, do when you write. We all do it because we love it. And it, yeah, should, and it's fun.
Yeah.
It's not you. I'm doing this because, yeah, I love it and it's painful. I mean, then, yeah, you're a masochist, I guess.
Totally.
Right? So I feel like we do it because we love it. You like, when you're sitting down and you're writing, or you're sitting, yeah, down creating music, or I'm taking pictures, it's like, it's just such a loving, that's so, I feel like always like, you got to have fun and you got to express that fun.
Yeah.
How much you love doing what you're doing. And I think that's where social media can come in.
Yeah.
When you're filming stuff or recording, yeah, stuff, and you, yeah, let people know that, like, yeah, you can pour your heart out into, yeah, something. I know you do it with your words. I, yeah, do it with my art.
Yeah.
But you can still, yeah, have fun with it.
Totally. Well, and I also, too, because I had the Kickstarter thing, and because it didn't go the way I thought it was going to go, because the Mike Garson piece spiraled, snowballed very quickly into something bigger than I had thought it was. And so I then was feeling behind. And I am the kind of person, like, I started feeling guilty. You know, I felt like, oh, my God. Now, every dime of my Kickstarter went directly to the music, like directly. And as you know, like, I sold my house, like a lot more money went in behind, exactly, it. But it became hard for me. I felt like kind of guilty of, like,
yeah,
here I am, I'm living in Paris, but like, trust me, I'm working on it. Like, yeah, how could I explain myself? So I kind of went a little more insular than maybe I needed to. But that's, right, my trip. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
But nobody, yeah, was, I understand, judging that. But I totally understand that. I did a crowdfunding, yeah, think campaign last year, and I totally feel the same thing. Like, I'm not doing enough. These people believe in me and I'm just not, I need, yeah, to do more.
Yeah.
And you just, it is, yeah, it's tough. And, yeah, that's why I always tell everybody to just relax, breathe.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you can answer the question, are you doing the best you can? Then,
yeah,
you're doing,
and the, you best, know, you can. Maybe be less perfectionistic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think, like, because of the speed of social media and the speed of how everybody's seeing things and getting things in 8 seconds, 10 seconds, right, 15 seconds, like, if you're a perfectionist, like I am, like, I hear music in a fine-tuned way.
Yeah, but if you're a perfectionist, how can you be a perfectionist in, like, jazz? Because jazz has room to breathe and to flow and to go off.
But that's when I'm in the moment, Mike Garson and I, yeah, anything you ever hear of what we've done, yeah, we do live.
Yeah.
I'm in the, right, let me tell you, when I'm in the booth and that piano,
yeah,
if you listen to Not Alone,
yeah,
and especially Rock and Roll Suicide, it was maybe the fourth take. It was the first time we were with the band. Mm-hmm. So it was the bass, drums, and Mike and I. And I mean, like, I'm part of me is like, oh my God, just keep singing, singing, because so I'm like, what the fuck?
We're running out of,
my God.
It's like, we're out of
tape. Are you hearing this? Like,
I can see you, like, we're running out of tape. Oh wait, there is no tape. Damn it.
I'm just like, is this happening? I mean, I'm so a, yeah, huge fan.
Yeah.
But he and I really swirl off of each other. Yeah. And like the first time we recorded, we did some jazz stuff and he was like, we did one thing and I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, when you contain yourself, I get lost. I'm like, when you go off and just do you, that's when I know exactly where I am in the song. And he's like, that's so unusual. You're like very rare. Most singers don't say that. He would say a lot to me. Like, it was very weird when he would say things like, you know, that you're very similar to Bowie like that. Yeah. That happened a lot where he would say to me, you're really similar. That's how Bowie. So, I'm like, what?
Somebody says that to me. I go, I can die now. Let's call it a day.
That's how I felt.
But I think it also probably has to do with the fact that you weren't doing music professionally for a very long time. Yeah. So it's like you also didn't pick up these like different bad habits and these different kind of very prescriptive ways of being.
So, right.
Which is like for me, because I do stand up and because I've been able to have some headway with it, like in a different way, because I didn't start doing stand up when I was 18. You know what I mean? So it's like I came to it like without a bunch of bad habits.
Yeah.
You know, like I just came to it with like what I enjoyed about it and who I liked and what my influences were, but I didn't have firm opinions about the process of it.
Right. You know or how I mean? It needed to be. Like you weren't adhering to any box. Like, this is how you have to be.
I hadn't absorbed any kind of rules.
Yeah.
Like other than just like, I like that guy. I don't like that. That's kind of what I want to sound like. Like beyond that, like there was no, and so in certain ways that can free you. Because even if people have been like doing it a little longer than you, like you have this different kind of head start, which is like you don't have like a, you know, like when you're swimming and you have like a drag suit on to kind of make you take longer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like you don't have that. And like a lot of people, I think when they get these like rules and these ideas about the way to make art or the way to do it well,
it becomes
a drag suit that they're trying to race in. And then like you can kind of jump in without any of that shit on.
Totally.
And like, you know what I mean? And be far more competitive than they thought you were. Because you are able to come from a different point of view, a different perspective, you know, you've been an audience longer, you know, so it creates a different.
That is totally true. And Evan was one of the first people who said that to me, because he was like, it's the way you hear. Because of my lack of training, I guess, like he's like, yeah, but that's why you put weird chords together and you structure things kind of sometimes in quirky ways that like isn't really normal. I remember I did a show with Rami and all these amazing musicians, like this kind of big come one, come all like jam session thing. And I'm like, well, I'm going to do this song. And it was really simple. It was like three chords, but then it had this weird turnaround and everybody was like, wait, what? And they like made me repeat it. And I'm like, oh, is that weird? Like I didn't really necessarily know. So yeah, you're totally right. Like how you... And even maybe that's also been like my first record, All These Things, is an album. This whole second half of it was co-write with Rami and Mike, and it has all these different influences and it's very up and down. And one song you might be like, did she do that in Minneapolis kind of alt country? As one is like total jazz, don't bother getting up, aka the heroin song. Like it's full on jazzy kind of, it just goes up and down this album. But for that, a lot of business people in the music business, well, we love it. It was before Florence and the Machine too, this record came out, and it's a very big, lush production, but they're like, oh my God, this record is amazing. But
how do we sell it?
Yeah.
How do we make money?
Yeah. So what's the choice? I mean, I'd rather make something that feels like kind of unique and authentic and cool to me than... I think Mike Farrell, for the album we have coming out later this year, Owl Songs, I think actually, because it was born out of my first record, we sat down, it was kind of, the question was on the table, like, okay, so is this to try and make money, or is this to just follow the muse? And I was like, follow the muse. I mean, like, there was no question. And even now, background to that leap of faith and, like, selling your house or quitting your job or whatever those things take, that's the question. Like, if I did all of this and my end goal was really to like have quote success, financial success, it would be really hard and kind of sucking right now, I have to tell you. Like, and I even about 8 months ago was walking, I was in Paris and I was still struggling. I hadn't put the record out yet. I didn't know which one was coming up first. Like, I was it was a tough window. And I remember thinking, like, I had this thought, like, well, why, what is your definition of success, Jillian? Why would you think you're not successful? You set out to make a record.
Yeah, you're walking in Paris and you made,
and when I listen to the music, it's what I set out to make. Like, it matches my description. My friend was like, you wanted to make torch glam avant-garde.
Mm-hmm.
Like, torch avant-garde. That was your thing. Like, because I'm not a jazz singer in a very strict jazz sense of the word, but I have that in my bass, like that kind of torchy sort of way. Very emotional. Like, I sing from a super emotional place.
When you say
place.
Jazz singer, the first thing comes to my mind is Neil Al Jarreau.
Oh, I'm like Neil Diamond.
No, Al Jarreau. I'm thinking.
I'm a very Al Jarreau type singer. No,
like, no, it is just funny. That's the first thing comes. That's one of the first singers I
Neil
saw.
Neil Diamond
back
was the first thing that came to my mind. The jazz, because the movie.
I know what you're saying, but like.
So yes. Yeah, you know,
I mean, French version of Sweet Caroline.
Oh my God, there's so much French music to do. That's my whole next trajectory. It's a never ending. Ending thing, you know, and it's a challenging time, but you know, I don't know. I will never not do music. And back again to my friends who I feel struggle and are in pain.
Yeah.
I feel like, thank you, because even if sometimes I'm bummed out, if it feels frustrating, like it's hard, if it feels hard, I'm like, yeah, well, life is hard first off. But second off, yeah, sometimes and right now music can be a challenge. And if you're indie, it can be even more challenging. You know, there's a lot of ways at it, but that's not necessarily easy. And so I come back, I circle back around and I'm like, you know, but like my soul needed it. My heart needed it. Mike Garson was right. You know, it was a soul's journey. And I live in the city that I feel.
But can you imagine the last 5 years not doing these last 5 years? Can you imagine not doing all what you just did?
No.
What you created? Oh,
no.
My God.
No. And so, I come back around and I go like, okay, I did, you know, you did the thing that you, it's your
life.
Yeah. And it's the soul's journey. And it's like, so then I come around and I think, okay, well, so will you stop doing music? I'm like, no, I'll never not do music. And then you shift your perception. You do shift your perception of what is success. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing it? What does it mean? Is it okay if I just sing in some clubs here or there and I have my day job, but I save my money and every few years I'm not going to always have a house to sell. I'm not going to always do it at this level, but will it be okay if I just always put out a few songs? Like, you have to ask yourself that, like, what's your aim? You know what I mean? Like, what's the, and I never was, you know, I heard some dudes on some radio show. I was in Paris listening to some, they weren't French, they were American. And I was like trying to, you know, I don't know who they were, what they were talking about, but their whole spiel was like, they ended up in fitness and they were talking about how they wanted to be rock stars when they were young. And maybe one of them had been successful in music or something. And I guess because I worked in makeup and hair and I was around so many dudes who were rock stars, you know, and I thought to myself, I was like, oh yeah, I was never young and like wanting that. That I never was like, I want to be that. Like, I loved, I was 12 years old at Farewell to the Who at the LA Coliseum, like 20 feet from the stage, just, I think I was singing Ooh Ollie because I was 12 and I didn't know it was Who Are You? Like, I mean, but I was like, but I wasn't like, oh, I want to be that, like in a fame kind of way. Right. That was never my drive, really. So maybe that was another.
Yeah, but it sounds like your journey is your journey, and
totally.
As I always say, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes shit just happens.
Well, and to sing, I guess maybe a lot of people say to me, because of the kind of way I sing and the sort of way my music is, it's very emotion. Like it's there. Like it's real. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, yeah, but probably I had to go through the not doing it.
Right.
And the feeling that torture.
Yeah.
Of
you
got
to live life. And, you know, that's why, like, I meet lots of young singers and they're just, like, boring because they haven't lived life. They haven't suffered enough.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you
they
do.
They write songs
but
about
isn't
their
that weird?
Boyfriends.
But how do you come around to that? Like, you know, same with anything, with comedy, you know what I mean? With, like, everything that you've lived that you find that humor in or that the singing in or your creativity, like the photo, all of that stuff, your eye, the way you see things is colored from all of those layers of years. It's so interesting to me because there's this weird paradigm going on where that is the necessity to create something that has a certain something that can only come from that place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we live in this youth-driven kind of culture. So isn't that a trip?
It's just
like,
crazy.
What's going to happen? You know, like, how is that going to be? And I mean, you know, I have, but then I say to people, and especially whatever music business, I'm like, oh, you don't know who my audience is, or you don't believe. I have a bunch of like 20 somethings who love what I do. And then I have like 40, 50, 60 somethings. Like, there's no, so You just, I mean, yeah.
But the beauty of now is that you can find your audience. You don't have to wait for like some big industrial thing right. to yes. support it. It's like, and so yeah. I would say the power of social media and not being a perfectionist is like, that's the place to be yourself, because that's the place where they identify with you as an artist, and then they go check out your art, and that's where exactly. they can see your perfection.
Yeah.
And like, I've been very good at social media for that reason.
Yeah.
Which is like, I've always just been myself.
Yeah.
There and been available in that way, you know, and like everything, of course, it's curated to an extent, you
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
But just the way when you go to a party, you have manners.
Yeah.
But like,
oh, that's a cool way of saying it.
You know, but at the end of the day, my Twitter is not a place for people to see my work. It's a place for them to see me and identify with me and feel like we have something in common. And
yeah.
then they go find the work.
Yeah.
And like, so that's yeah. how it's become an effective tool, is like, because it allows you to find the people yeah. that think the way you do
yeah.
and have the same feelings you do and are going to be into your stuff. And those are the people who are going to support you forever. I've had Twitter followers I've had since I got on Twitter like 6 years ago
yeah.
that will still buy anything. Like, if I'm like, I'm putting out this thing, or like, they'll buy tickets, they'll show up.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That those are relationships that are never going to go away. Like,
yeah.
those are going to be like fans for life,
yeah.
you know? And like, the cool thing about social media is like, by being yourself over a long period of time.
Yeah.
Like, you get these fans that, like, those are the people that are going to, like, carry you through.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of, they're going to yeah. buy the records.
Yeah.
They're going to go to the Kickstarter and donate yeah. that money. So
that is totally true. And you know
so
what?
That's why, like, don't worry about being a perfectionist on Twitter. Just be yourself.
But also really, like, be yourself. And yeah. even what I've learned now is be my raw and emotional self if
yeah.
I need to be. Because what is really true is that every one of my Kickstarter fans, out of 136, there's maybe one person who was a little like, hey, what's going on? But like, all of them, every time I would post like him something like, I'm stressed and I'm sorry, whatever, they were like, we believe in you.
Yeah.
We know you're going to come up with an amazing thing
exactly.
at the end. We
yeah.
know, just follow your heart. We trust. We believe. Like, every one of them, they were just,
yeah.
And it's that authenticity. When the album came out, Duran Duran was posting links, you know, and John and his involvement. And it's the same reason I think why John got involved in the project. And a bunch of Duran Duran fans, some of them had that exact response, like, oh, you're so authentic. They use the word authentic.
Yeah.
A bunch of Brazilian. I have a lot yeah. of Brazil people. Shout out Brazil. Like, they're like, they're, but they're like, oh, it's because it's so
is it
authentic.
All the Astrid Gilberto fans?
I don't know. No, they're Duran Duran. They're Duran Duranis. They're Duranis. John Taylor.
Well, speaking of social media, how can people find you? Like, where can they? Like,
okay, so
like, let's sell some wares. Let's
oh
do this.
Oh my God, do I even know them? Oh shit, Melanie's gonna kill
you know,
me.
You know,
I don't know. I didn't
you know
write
it.
Them down.
We're telling
your Twitter is
Jalanism.
At Jalanism, and my Facebook is Jalan.music. And
spell
my
can you spell it?
J I L A N N.
Okay.
.music and Jalanism. Twitter, Jalanism. Instagram, Jalanism. And Facebook, Jalan.music. And my website, which I think is the best place to sort of find
okay.
most of my world. Not the best place, but like, my album is for sale on
okay.
my website. And I put a, hopefully, you know, this album, I have, because it's covers, I pay. So I had to kind of put a minimum, but so it's like a $7, but like, it's a pay for what you want kind of thing. But it's downloadable there, and it's like a high, it's a higher res download from my website than it is from iTunes.
Good.
But I have all my music there
okay.
and at jalan.com.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you for stopping by.
Thank and, you guys so much.
You guys know where to find me at my website, ilovesav.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can download it on SoundCloud. You can find me on Twitter at Sovereign Sire, on Instagram at Sovereign_Sire, on Snapchat Sovereign Sire. You can find me on YouTube, my history show, Boss Bitches of History, on the Wisecrack channel. I'm probably forgetting things. You can always come see me do stand-up all over LA. Bye.